You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. My name is Stuart Goldsmith and today I'm recording from a rainy street, having completely forgotten to sort the blurbs out for this week. It's all been hell for leather, so thanks very much to my editor, Nathan Wood, for putting this all together for me and for making the show sound as nice as I'm sure it does. So this week we have the brilliant Zoe Lyons, who, as you'll hear, she's one of those comics in whose orbit I've recently found myself. We did that thing of not gigging together for, I mean, years and years, and then suddenly hitting all the same gigs for a period of about 6 weeks or so. And I saw her do some fantastic work in Estonia and at the Stand, where this podcast is recorded, at Stand Towers, the flat over the road. So thanks very much to the Stand for having us. And here is Zoe. She's a phenomenal comic, and I think this is a really fun interview. It was a fairly meandering one, but I think that was the mood we were both in. So without further ado, this is Zoe Lyons. So we were in, we have done that thing recently that is a lovely treat as comedians, whereby you don't gig with each other for years, yes. And then we do literally 5 gigs in the space of a month.
It's been strange, hasn't it?
In the last month, yeah. We've gigged in Brighton.
Yeah.
I came and did Bent Double for
yes.
you.
Yes,
oh,
that was my show.
6 weeks ago or something. Which is your Sunday night...
Sunday Night's a Comedian.
Comedian Brighton.
Slightly camp.
Yeah, love yeah. Bent Double, great name.
Lovely, isn't it?
We did that. We did the Tallinn Comedy Festival in Estonia.
We're huge in Estonia.
We're massive over there. And we're doing the Stand in Edinburgh at the moment. It's yes. like in the space of a month.
Yeah. And we literally haven't worked together for, I would say it's years, Stu.
Unless I think it's probably years.
Unless you've been on bills together in the Edinburgh Festival.
Not even that. No. I don't know that we have.
Strange, isn't it? We did used to gig together an awful lot more in the early days, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you're with Christian Knowles now, who
I am.
Used to be my agent.
Yes.
So there
it's
is.
All very
it's
small.
All very incestuous.
It's all connected. We've all touched each other in various ways, yes.
So something I really noticed, I want to talk a bit about the Tallinn gig. We'll dive straight into material and stuff like that, and then yeah. we'll pull back and hear about your fascinating growing up in Scotland yeah. story that you mentioned earlier on. But something that really struck me about the gig you did in Tallinn was that you did some stuff about buying a banana that cost €5. Yeah. And it was a sort of a 3 or 4 minute bit.
Yeah.
And it involved a really great act out of eating this banana and all the rest of it. And then afterwards you said that had literally happened to you that day.
Yes.
Or the previous day.
No, it happened that day on my way from, because I'd gone to Tallinn the most weird way via Copenhagen. It had taken about a day to get there. And I'd been to Copenhagen the airport before, so I was aware that I was, I wasn't rich enough to buy a sandwich there.
It's, yes.
If you've ever been to Scandinavia, you know you can't treat yourself to a sandwich. What the hell do you think you are, Rockefeller? So I thought, well, surely I'm in the banana sort of zone of the budget area. And, bought banana, but I've no idea of the currency either. I'm really bad when I go travelling. I'm just like, take the discs that correspond to the price of the banana. And I think I spent about €5 on a banana. And I just sat and thought about it for a while and I just turned it into a little routine when I was
so
at the
did
airport.
You, oh, so you turned it into a routine at the airport. It wasn't that it... That's interesting. So you put some thought into doing it on stage
yes.
before you did it on stage.
Yes, yeah,
I'm
yeah.
relieved to hear that because yeah. otherwise I'd have to cope with the idea yeah. that you a little thing could happen and then just four minutes.
But I think all comedians do that as things are occurring to you. I mean, you could be slipping off the side of a cliff facing imminent death and there's a part of your brain going, this could be material.
Where are the beats in this?
Yeah,
this is, cliff
yeah,
story.
Yeah, so everything that occurs has that sort of So yes, as I'm handing over more and more change to this woman in Copenhagen Airport, you're going, this is funny in my head. I like the awkwardness of those sorts of situations, particularly when you're on your own, you know, and you spend so much time on your own doing this that you have to find the funny in all of the little things.
Yes.
Even if it's for your own amusement.
I worry that I don't spot nearly as much funny stuff as I could because I'm by nature a problem solver.
Yes.
Like I think comedy comes from having problems with things, like being disgusted at the price of a banana, not having the right money for a banana, the banana itself being problematic when you get it. And I think I miss loads of potential comedy things because my system is I will have worked out in advance how much the banana is likely to cost.
Yes.
I've got the correct money. And if it doesn't get the correct money, I will work out a way to, I was going to say, steal the banana.
Yes.
But you know what I mean? I'll solve the problem. Do you think that you are attuned now to problems?
I don't know whether I'm attuned to problems. I'm very much attuned to awkwardness. I really enjoy awkwardness.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Because I hate it. I cringe and I can't wait to get out of there. And afterwards I think a real comedian would have stayed in that moment
I think because we have to expose ourselves to so much awkwardness. Being on your own so much, eating on your own, travelling on your own. There are so many awkward moments where that in the end you just sort of revel in them. They become your companions and they become your stories that you take around with you.
I want to dig a bit deeper into that because I like the idea of that. Mm. But how much is that like a funny thing to say? And how much is that actually, if you put yourself in the situation now of something incredibly awkward that just happened today, say, how much of it is like, do you actually enjoy the awkwardness of the moment as it's happening? Or are you cringing but thinking, I get to get something out of this?
Yeah, secretly? There's an element of cringing but thinking I get to get something out of it. I remember a couple of years ago, I did the Melbourne Comedy Roadshow Festival, the Comedy Roadshow. So I went on the roadshow with the Melbourne comedy crew. And I had about 3 or 4 days on my own in Sydney. And you start to unravel a bit when you spend that much time on your own. And I thought, I'm going to treat myself one day. I thought, I'll go to Japantown and I'll get myself some really nice sushi. I thought, I'll treat myself. I went to this sushi bar in Japantown. I was the only non-Japanese person in there. And it was what I can only describe as, we're all used to sort of yo sushi here where you recognise things that are coming around the conveyor belt. I had never seen anything like it. It was like the Men in Black had unleashed aliens onto tiny little plates coming around this sort of sushi belt in Sydney. And I got more and more awkward because I just did not know what to eat. Honestly, they were coming past with like 4 or 5 eyes on, kind of going, hi, how you doing? I'm a gold plate. You want to eat me? I'm like, I have no idea what you are. And in the end, I think I had a miso soup and a piece of tuna and just left horribly and hurriedly and scuttled back to my room and sat in there. And I thought, that was brutal and awkward. But I'll turn it into something later. That'll be all right. I'll get some good stuff out of that later. Yeah. So I do kind of enjoy the awkwardness of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You said to me, this is good because this is I'm revealing now the fact that when, you know, comedians just say things in passing to me, I secretly write them down.
Yeah.
Let's kind of start with this. You said to me, every 2 years I get a creative dry patch.
Yeah.
And I feel like an imposter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about that for a bit because I think it was in the context of you felt that you were just coming out of it.
No, I think I'm still really in it.
Tell me about that.
It's awful. I had a really good show last year in Edinburgh and I put together what I think was a really good show and it was very well received and I probably had my best Edinburgh to date.
This was Mustard Cutter.
Yeah, and I felt really comfortable on stage and I was enjoying the material. And then since then, it's just, I found it really difficult to write stuff. Really difficult. And I'm not boasting here, but I do have a reputation on the circuit of being fairly prolific. I know people often say to me, oh, I'd never seen any of that stuff before.
Absolutely.
Or, you know, you always do new stuff, but I never feel there's enough there. And it's just, at the moment, it's just been really tough. To the point where you go, I don't know if I'll write anything ever again. So when I do something like get on stage and make a routine out of a banana incident that day, that makes me feel so much better. That makes me feel like I'm connected and doing something. And I've since taken it and I'm sort of turning into a little routine here. I've been doing it for the last few nights in Edinburgh, the banana thing. And you sort of go, okay, I'll try and work on that and take it somewhere else.
But there's still that has a sense, doesn't it? Or does it, that underneath that you're like, oh God, I've got to get something out of this. Yeah. I've got to prove to someone, to me.
Yeah, yeah. You constantly, you never switch off, do you, as a comedian? I mean, you never switch off. You might have a day off, but it's not a day off, is it? You never switch off from yourself. You're constantly on. And even if you're just sort of a low-level hum, there's always something, you know, there's always that feeling that you should be producing something, and when you just can't or haven't, it's awful.
And let's just see, how many hours have you done? What hour number was that?
Six.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you obviously, this is the thing, one of the crusades of this podcast is to convince people who are brilliant that they should relax because it's okay, they're definitely brilliant. And I can see in your body language now is sort of like, no. I won't have it.
No.
So you've done 6 hours. Does the beginning of writing a new hour, does that feel like, oh God, how am I going to do it? Or does it feel like, this is going to come, but it's going to take hard work? Do you feel confident about it? Like that kind of the tabula rasa stage of going, right, all of that stuff's kicked out.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm approaching that point where I'm quite happy to chuck out everything I've done and start again. I'm starting to feel a little bit better in myself and that I can sit down and write some new stuff now.
Okay.
But it has been, where are we now? It's May, June, you know, it's September, October, 6-7 months of, like, not a lot.
Really?
Not a lot.
So what's a usual week for you in terms of your turnover, your kind of, like, do you describe your writing week to me? Yeah, and it could be
don't have a writing process. When people say to me, what's your writing process? There really isn't one. There's no set way of producing stuff. I do a lot of walking, and I think a lot when I'm walking.
Okay.
And showers, that's for a lot of things.
There's a thing online.
If I'm well exercised and wrinkly, I know I've been thinking a lot.
there's a thing online, I think, called shower thoughts, like hashtag shower thoughts,
yeah.
Which are moments when they're almost like perfectly formed Stephen Wright jokes.
Yeah.
You know, you go, oh my God.
I must remember that before I condition my... Oh, I've forgotten it.
Yeah, right.
I need a waterproof pad in the shower or something to write on.
Do you ever go, right, today I'm having it... Like, I've seen you in here where it's Stand Towers in Edinburgh, and I've seen you kind of going, I'm going to do some work.
Yeah.
And you're writing on your iPad.
Yeah.
So what's that? What part of the process is that? Is that something that you've thought about as you were walking, or you've tried to buy a banana in an airport and you said it once conversationally?
Yeah.
So then, okay, that exists in some form.
So then I'll write that down and then I'll try and sort of think of jokes around it. It's more to log it so I don't forget it and, you know, so I don't lose it.
And when you say think of jokes around it, are you kind of going, like, what's the... Let's try and trace the kind of the path of how you dig into it. Like, what things do you pull out of it? Do you go, okay, it was in an airport, here's what I think about airports? Or do you go, what's the emotional core of the situation?
Yeah, I mean...
I know this is impossible question I'm asking you.
My approach to comedy is quite physical and I would say fairly surface. Mm-hmm. And I'm not doing myself... So whenever I approach a new routine, often... I act a lot of stuff out and I get the jokes from acting things out. So when I did it in Tallinn for the first time and I just put on the accent of the and people laughed, so I did it a bit more and then you did it a bit more and then you embellish it and then you sort of work on that. That's how it sort of comes about. That's how it sort of starts, and then I'll write bits down, I'll write keywords down, and then I'll try and, you know, think where else I can take it. Often there's a brick wall and nothing else is there. I'll be very honest. Often you kind of go, well, that's that bit done. That's that.
So are there, when you're kind of doing act outs, are you on stage, is part of you kind of going, I've got to log this? Are you recording your gigs when you do them?
I will record my previews now. I'm much better at doing that. I'll record previews. And if I have a thought on stage that or something... something gets developed on stage, I'll come off and write that down.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm not very good at recording all of my gigs. I mean, I no disrespect to you and I no disrespect to your listeners either, but I hate the sound of my own voice. Yeah. So I find it
it's
really...
hard. It's hard to put yourself through it.
Oh.
And I tell you what, the thing that I've been... I think I had a real creative spurt earlier this year And then I've kind of slightly regressed from how exciting that was, creating all this new stuff. At the moment, I'm in a period of like doing every gig, recording every gig, listening to it the next day or the next writing time, and then kind of sort of picking it apart and going, oh, I said that slightly better. Maybe that can go further. And I think what I've got, I've sort of got caught in this trap of like endlessly finessing the same stuff. I feel like I've sort of described it like pushing food around the plate.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That I'm sort of, like, I don't know that I'm being as creative as I was a couple of months ago because I've made a wodge of stuff. And so I no longer have the absolute cold fear of, oh shit, I've got to create some stuff.
Yeah. But there's real benefit to be taken from finessing it as well, though.
I think so, but I think in the past I've ended up with a half-good idea that's really well finessed. Do you know what I mean? And so when it works, it's really great, but it's unreliable. You can't trust it.
The golden turd.
Exactly, exactly right. It's polished to within an inch of its life. Yeah. So what I'm trying to do now is save all the finessing for July.
Yes.
And just work on creating new stuff. That was the plan when I was happily producing loads of stuff 2 months ago.
Well, welcome to my world, yeah.
So what? Yeah. So have you? Do you recognise this process for you? Are you like, oh, this is the bit where I'm in a rut, it's going to be okay?
Yes, I'm not so good at recognising it. My wife is very good at recognising it and goes, so we've been here before. Yeah, as I'm sort of sat in the corner in a onesie rocking back and to, and she's like, love, we've been here before. And I'm like, no, we haven't. This has never been this bad. And she's like, no, we really have. We have. It'll be fine. And she's very good at kind of going, yeah, you plateau for about 4 months and then you'll pop out the other side. You'll come up with some joke about a bin bag and you'll pop out the other side and you'll be happy for a week.
And that's it, isn't it? There's some element whereby... Do you think, this is, I'll stop making pronouncements myself, do you think that your creativity is linked to how much you believe in yourself?
Oh, totally. But my problem is I don't believe I'm very creative. So I'll explain that.
She says 6 hours in. I love it. I love comedians. Look at us. God, go on.
I think the creative side of my... Or being a creative... is the weaker side of my comedy persona. I believe I'm a funny person with funny bones and very good at clowning and mimicking, and I find the writing and the creating the hardest part. That's when I first started doing comedy, it kind of dawned on me that I was not the most... I was so thrilled to be doing it, you know, and I to get on the stage and to have started doing stand-up. And then of course, then you shine a light on it and you go, oh right, you're this is what you are. It's like watching a drunk cross the road. They have all the confidence of the... But they have no skill in coordination. And I know, 12 years in, that I am not the most original creative person. That's where all my self-doubt hangs. I know I can get on stage and perform. I'm a very, very good performer, and I love to perform, but my self-doubt hangs on whether my stuff is creative enough, original enough, good enough.
Yes, because as soon as you recognise you're a good performer, then presumably the negative voices go, well, obviously you're a good performer, Zoe.
Yeah.
That's not up for grabs.
Perform the hell out of this shit.
Yes, perform the hell out of this this hacky shit that anyone could do, sort of thing. You know? Yeah. I'm speaking... feels very wrong to be speaking the voice of someone else's discontent.
You've seen my act.
Not at all. Because if you look at... that hour that I saw you do recently in Tallinn, there's stuff, and again, we were in Oxford as well the other week as well.
Of course,
So to look at that stuff, something that I kind of, the way I think of your stuff is you're really good at finding really good topics to then get loads of stuff out of, like your stuff about wine in a bag. You get your teeth into that subject and get loads and loads and loads of stuff out.
I have milked that routine.
Yeah, but part of the job is milking the routine, isn't it? There's no point having one observation and then moving on. You might as well get your teeth in and come up with every single... See, it's very satisfying. Something my fiancé was saying about about that set, because she was there at the time. And she was like, I think you should try and do that, Stu. She just has, like, three topics... And then just spends 10 minutes on each, and bang, that's a set.
Yeah.
And I was like, "That's a really good point." I think it instills a lot of confidence in the viewer. You kind of go, "Oh, she's not just she hasn't just got a grab bag together of bits of jokes that work."
Yeah,
it sort of displays like I'm doing this subject, and here's everything on that subject.
I think I've said everything that needed to be said about boxes of wine. I just recently did that routine again on television, and I went, that will now die. That will be put to bed, that routine.
It's a while old, is it?
Yeah, it's going to now be rested.
Okay. How long have you had that routine for?
2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what, you're already thinking, oh, this is, I've done that for too long?
Yeah. So I think once you've done it on the telly box as well, then it's like, okay, bye-bye. And you do it, you're going to go, I will... It's almost like killing it. Well done, my child, you have done your job.
And when you wrote that, let's just stay with that routine for a minute, because it's one I can imagine very clearly. What was the seed, what was the kernel of that idea?
We were on holiday in France, and... We were at my brother's wedding in France, and it was quite a boozy affair. And it was just a box of wine in the shelf in the fridge, and I was like, God, they're great, because nobody can tell how much you've had. And yes. that was just a guilty secret thought.
Yeah.
Because it just sits there, and I was like, nobody can tell that I've been on this since 10 o'clock this morning, because you're on holiday.
And that line, that observation, comes at about halfway through what's now kind of a 10-minute routine.
Yeah.
That's really interesting to see that it's grown in front and it's grown afterwards as well. Because I remember when, by the time you get to that observation, we've had quite a lot on wine and boozing and your relationship to booze.
Yeah. Yeah.
So do you start with the observation... And then what's the next bit? I mean, you might not remember exactly in what order it came, but is it just a case of saying that on stage and going...
Yeah, I mean, I did not write that routine. It just occurred.
Okay.
They occur on stage. You know, you will just... I'll have a thought, and then... So then I'll write that thought down, but then the routine will just develop on stage.
So the first time you try and do that thought on stage to help that it develops, are you wedging that in on a Friday night gig, or are you doing it in a new stuff night between two good bits?
I tend to do a lot of new stuff at my show, Bent Double, at Brighton, because I host it every month and it's a very regular crowd. So they've seen all my stuff. So every month I've got to do new stuff. And it's a really popular gig, and I know I've got to do stuff that will land. So I perform it with gusto, and that's usually where I develop stuff from there.
Something I notice about that routine is that every joke has got a tag on top of a tag on top of a tag. And the other thing is it's got an image on top of an image. Like, you're really good at imagery.
I work in pictures.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Yeah, I just work in pictures.
So do you draw routines ever, or are you just...
Just think in pictures.
How do you know that? How do you... Compared to what?
I don't know. It's just the way I work. I'm very because my stuff is very animated, and I do clown about quite a lot. Mm. It is very visual, so I work in my mind. Jokes work in pictures. Yes. I stopped being quite so physical on stage a few years ago because I felt I was 40 at the time, and I thought, is this undignified? I really did. I kind of went, do I look like a total dick? And I stopped being so physical on stage. And again, it was my wife who went, why have you stopped that then? She went, that's what makes you funny. I went, I guess it is. And people do enjoy it when I have no shame. I will lark about like an arsehole now.
So this is Zoe. She's so naturally funny, and I really urge you to check out her shows. I believe she's at Edinburgh again this year. And she's not. She's definitely not. We've talked about this. Yes, she isn't. So tough. But I'm sure you can see her at a club near you somewhere or on tour. Do check out her online presence as well. So back to the rest of the conversation with Zoe in a moment. I've got some fantastic episodes in the can. I didn't want to tell you until I'd actually recorded it, but I have now got an episode with Matt Lucas, who came round to my actual flat this week. And so that one is in the can. A fantastic comedian. We've got some really good stuff on George Dawes coming up in that episode, and as well as Pompidou and his feelings about the critical reception to Pompidou, which is, as he would describe, his favourite project, the project that he's most proud of, and how that has been fairly panned by a lot of audiences. So Some interesting stuff on that, and also one of my favourite ever answers to the question, are you happy? That's coming up with Matt Lucas, all in good time. Dara O'Brien is in the can. I believe next week we're going to bring you Will Anderson. I know I've been promising you the Ian Stone podcast for a long time. That's been in the can for a couple of weeks, but it will come out of the can after we've done Will Anderson. And those of you who've been paying attention online will know that I've booked the final guest and made that public for the Soho Theatre shows. Will Anderson is the 2nd of June. That's Tuesday next week, and the final one on the 7th of July at Soho Theatre. And remember to use the discount code FAF to get 25% off your tickets. The final guest is none other than Adam Buxton. It will be such a pleasure to welcome Adam to the show. He is a genuinely prodigious creator of things. You'll be aware of Adam online. You'll know him from the Adam and Joe podcast, which is one of the first podcasts I ever got into. Absolutely brilliant. And also from his numerous other projects. He's one of those people who just noodles away in his shed, chucking out video after interview, after animation, after song. I cannot wait to get to the bottom of Adam's creativity. So that's all coming up soon. You can get tickets for those at sohotheatre.com. I will be announcing the Edinburgh Fringe lineup very soon. And remember, you can, of course, come and see me at the Edinburgh Festival at the Cannon's Gate at 4:55 p.m. daily with my own solo show entitled An Hour. And you can come and see in the last fortnight, you can come and see live ComCom. I've got news of an exciting Kickstarter project coming to you soon, so keep them peeled for that. And thank you once again for all your donations. They're very, very much appreciated. The Kickstarter is going to show you a tangible use for your donation. So if you haven't donated yet and you're looking forward to doing that, then the Kickstarter project will be exactly up your street, I think. So look out for that coming soon. And yes, you can donate if you like at comedianscomedian.com. Go to the PayPal button and you can enter whatever amount of money you think is appropriate. I've got to brush up my bottling skills. Bottling is the process by which a street performer asks you for money at the end of a show. I've been banging on. I've not done the Free Fringe for several years, and I've been telling all the Free Fringe acts in the meantime, oh, you've got to do it like this, this and this, and now I have to apply those rules to my own show, so that you come and see me attempt to do that like back in the old days. So the Edinburgh shows are at Black Medicine at 11 p.m. in the last fortnight of the Edinburgh Festival, and we've already booked Jason Byrne, we've got Daniel Sloss, and we've got some very exciting people on a pencil as well. I'll bring you more names as and when I know them, but keep them peeled and look at ComComPod for more details on those. That's everything for now. Thanks for all those donations, and thanks to the one or two people who've pressed a bit of cash into my hand in the meantime. James, thank you for coming to that gig at the Finsbury, and many others of you besides. So thank you very much. This is the conclusion of my conversation with Zoe Lyons.
It's quite unusual about you, just talking to you now, is you seem very comfortable going, I'm a really funny performer, I've got funny bones. Mm. And that's something people are normally kind of like, well, you know, I don't know if I...
Yeah, because I'm equally comfortable with telling you what my weak points are.
I'm not accusing you of being overly kind of, you know, proud or anything.
I'll very happily expose my underside as well.
Yeah, but it's nice. The aspect of it that isn't about the underside, you know, that positivity about going, I'm a funny person.
Yeah.
How do you... Like, that interests me, because I'd love to have that kind of self-belief.
Oh, well, but you must have, because you can't fake it for, because you've been going slightly less than me.
Slightly, a couple of years less.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you know you've got to be a funny person if you've been doing it for...
No, my neurosis goes, I've been getting away with this the whole time.
Of course, but I think every comedian feels that. Every comedian feels that. For a very, very long time, every time I went on stage, my initial thought was, I'm the weak link here. This is the point where the show goes tits up. I'm the weak link. But then once you realise that most people feel like that, you just have to sort of put it to the side, and it's just background noise.
Something Ian Stone said to me is that he came to a point where he just stopped caring. And he was saying it's not about stopping caring. I think what he meant was he stopped caring about whether or not they liked him.
Mm.
And on that day, he went, oh, I'm just gonna do this.
Yeah.
Flum, you know.
Yeah.
I suppose, do you care about whether or not they like you?
I think you've got to care whether or not they like you, because otherwise, and it's just a really awkward situation of perhaps up to 200 people not liking you at the same...
But can they find you funny and not like you?
I guess.
With you, then, specifically with you, do they have to like you to laugh at you?
I don't know whether that's... I mean, we've all experienced the person in the audience who's just taken an instant dislike to you as you walk on stage. And, you know, I've had those gigs where you're doing really, really well, but there's just one person with their arms folded and looking at you like they want to kill you. And you go, this is obviously... I have no control over that.
No, so. Sure, but, I mean, that's in the case of an individual. But, yeah. Like, do you... I don't know, something I find is that they like me. Them liking me is really important to them.
Yeah.
It's probably important to me as well. And
but
if I say something...
You're very likeable on stage, and I think I'm likeable on stage. I think...
Yeah.
I think
you pander to them probably slightly less than I do. I think
really?
I'm trying to stop pandering to them quite so much. And they like you, but they respect you.
Possibly, yes. I mean, I know when I first started, I was... desperate for people to like me.
Okay.
You know, yeah, of course you have that. Like me, don't look at me like that. Love me, hold me close. And yes, of course, that lessens as you get older, I think, and more experienced. But you still want to be liked on stage, but it's just less. If I left feeling everybody'd hated me, I would get over it a lot quicker than I used to do. You know, it used to be crushing if you died horribly. I mean... I spent weekends in the fetal position on a sofa after an awful death at a gig. And I died at a gig maybe about 6 months ago, and I timed it. It took 20 minutes for me not to care afterwards.
You timed it?
Yeah.
I love it. I love every detail of that story. I'm very pleased for you that yeah. It's only taking 20 minutes now. And I love that's the sort of thing I do. If I get a flat tire, I time myself. Yeah.
I got in the car and I waited for the feeling to subside. And then I looked at the clock and I went, that was 20 minutes from leaving
that's
the stage.
Right.
to getting in the car and driving to feeling nothing again. Just like, oh, I'm back to zero.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah. But that's taken a few years to get to that point.
And when you say it's taken a few years, is it just time or is it kind of thinking on your part? Have you kind of learned to think your way out of it? Or is it just a case that it's just...
Yeah, sure. I mean, at certain gigs, it really isn't your fault at certain gigs.
Yep.
It really isn't. You know, the room's not set up right. They're not set up right. The promoter, you know, things are just not set up for comedy to succeed.
Sure.
It needs very few things, but they are important. And sometimes it's really not your fault. Sometimes it's entirely your fault. So it's being able to recognise when it was perhaps not your fault and when it was your fault. And even when it's your fault, hey, everybody has bad days at the office.
I think, actually, that thing of being able to go, oh, you know that bloke in the audience? I kind of turned him into a heckler.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Really, that's my fault.
Yeah.
And actually, if I can accept that, even though you kind of go, no, it wasn't, he attacked me. As soon as you can go, no, that was my fault, it does help you move on emotionally sooner, doesn't it? Well,
yeah.
I kind of shot myself in the foot there because...
This is what I did wrong. I misinterpreted
yes.
that. I put that sort of emphasis on this. I did that. Okay, nobody died. 50 people in Kent had a slightly disappointing evening, but we'll move on from it. We'll all live another day.
Something that happened to me the other night in Bracknell, a brilliant gig, the Comedy Cellar in Bracknell. I was doing a closing, whatever it was, 20, I think, and 2 minutes from the end, it'd been going really, really well. Someone was chatting in the audience really loudly and openly, not heckling, probably talking about the gig, but just loudly during quite a fragile, newer little bit that I was popping in. And I told her off and I said, it's probably sort of, it's kind of too near the end now for you to talk. And I tried to say it nicely, and the audience, if I tell someone off, they hate me because part of my relationship with them is based on warmth.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's anything I'm consciously trying to do, but there is some element whereby if they go, oh, he's being a bit of a dick, everyone just turns off me. It's like I've broken the code.
Yeah.
Do you have any kind of version of that? Do you have things where you go, oh, shit, I've lost this?
Possibly... trying new material that is... I tried something the other night that didn't quite work and I thought, I think this is making me sound racist. And I thought, that really isn't my intention in this piece of material. But because it wasn't so well thought out, and like I say, because I like to work things out on stage, I was going, oh, right, I'll have to pull away from this. Bring out the box of wine!
Yeah.
But... I've learned when it comes to taking on people in the audience or talking to people in the audience, I've seen so many comics misinterpret what's actually going on in the room.
Yes, God, yeah, absolutely.
And turn something into a situation that really doesn't need to be there.
Yes.
I never go in aggressively.
You've got to give everyone the maximum benefit of the doubt. Yeah.
Because I've seen things turn where you go, that didn't require that level of, that venom. That's gone nasty. So I always give people the benefit of the doubt.
Your crowd work is, again, excellent. This stuff when you were, the stuff about the black bread and the bloody sausage. Do you remember that, bit? Have you? That's a thing that wasn't recorded and will, I'm sure, never be repeated. But but I remember, like, you had a really good kind of a chat to someone about, you were asking what the national dishes of Estonia were. There was a bloody sausage, which was a bit of a gift. You did loads with it, and then later on you reincorporated it, and then later on it came up again. And, and like, I just wanted to talk to you kind of about crowd work. Obviously, you compare... Do you just compare your own club, or do you compare other clubs?
I do compare all the places, but mostly my own gig, yeah.
Okay, and what are your strategies for comparing? What advice would you give to someone that was new? What are the kind of the key principles of
doing it? It's listening, isn't it? It's really listening and taking your time. All of the stuff is there. You just have to listen and... slowing down when you're doing that sort of thing. Because I find if I get stressed or I get anxious or nervous, I don't know whether you find this, but the shutters of your mind sort of go and close down. They're like, we're out of here, so we'll just leave you with a face and a mouth. But the brain area is leaving for now. We're just going to work out our way back the tradesman's entrance. So if I slow right down and think and just give those extra beats to think about what somebody said to me, all it takes is an extra second. And it feels like a long time in your head, but it's nothing to an audience. It's nothing to an audience.
That's interesting. I find I've got to say the first thing that comes
mind. Give it a beat. Just give it a little bit of a moment. Because time works in different ways, doesn't it, for us and them?
That's a really... No one's made the observation before. Yes, I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
I'll listen back to a gig thinking, oh, I didn't do so well there. And then you listen back and you go, oh, no, actually, they liked it. And all the bits that I thought were huge gaping pauses where I couldn't remember what was coming next just sounded like I was being thoughtful.
Yeah. Yeah. Time works in different ways depending on which side of the stage you're on. So, because I tend to talk quite quickly on stage anyway. And the more, if I get nervous, then that ramps up. So I've had to learn to sort of just twist it the other way and just slow it right down, because nothing happens when you're at full breakneck speed. So, it's just having that 1 second or two.
And do you think that your persona on stage is the same as off stage?
It's a magnified version.
And which bits are you magnifying?
The physicalities. I mean, I do it anyway. I'm quite a sort of... I think I'm a fairly springy sort of a person. And I, you know...
That's a lovely way of putting it. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. You are springy.
You know, I will lark about. I will strike a pose just to make somebody laugh.
Okay.
You know, this is how I've had such a successful relationship. 17 years of striking poses and pulling faces. So I just exaggerate that part of it. And I'll make myself look a bit dumb. I'm not the brightest, so that's an exaggeration. But it's an exaggeration of something that's already there.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are there elements of yourself that you suppress or hide on stage?
I try and hide the... I suppose now, like talking about the comparing situations or the heckling situations, that's slightly aggressive side, you know, that could be there. Yeah, that I would hide that. Yeah, because there are times when you really just want to go, oh, fuck, you know, you just want to lose your shit, but you can't, you know, you've got to stay in control. I once lost it with a heckler. You do it once or twice and then you learn from it. I lost it with a heckler. It didn't end well for me or the heckler. It didn't end well for anybody in the room. You know what I mean? It was like... And I remember explaining it to somebody and somebody just said to me, yeah, you lost your sense of humour there, Zoe, didn't you? And I went, yeah, I totally did.
Oh, man.
I totally
did. That's the worst, isn't it? That's the worst defeat, really.
But it's your responsibility, I think.
Yeah.
To take control and keep control and to do it in a way that so...
That is my Achilles heel, is getting angry on stage.
Yeah.
If ever I get angry, if I just think someone is so
yeah.
stupid or offensive or racist or do you know what I mean? If I just go, oh, I can't be bothered with it. And I always think you people.
Yeah.
I tar the entire audience. Yeah.
So yeah, just learning to sort of at least look like you're still in control.
And how did you bring yourself to comedy? Who are you? You were saying before that you, as a teenager, you grew up in Scotland, in Edinburgh?
As a kid, we moved from... I grew up in Ireland, and then we moved to England, and then from England we moved to Scotland when I was about 10, 11, and I lived in Glasgow until I was about 17. I went to university at 17, went to an English university.
Okay.
I went as far away as possible. Yeah.
Where did you go? Which one was it?
Went to York. Actually, it wasn't as far away as possible. It was as far away
as
a mini metro would go in those days. Yeah. Yeah. So I went to school. I went to secondary school in Glasgow.
Yes.
Yes. With an English accent.
You said this in a... Yeah, I mean, that must have been a...
Yeah.
That must have been an issue. Was that an issue?
Well,
you were saying you weren't the class clown.
No.
But what, were you trying to be? Did you try
I discovered years later that my nickname at school was the freak.
Really?
Yeah, I was the freak. Yeah.
That's quite a good defensive position.
Well, I don't know. I didn't have many friends. I mean, the friends I did have were brilliant, and I'm still friends with them today.
Okay.
But it was an isolating period of time.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a period of time where you feel sort of... I was definitely the outsider, which is it's a comedy cliche, isn't it? I was so alone. I would just sit on my own. But I mean,
yes and no. I mean, it also might still be your true story. Like, not everyone had some. Not everyone was the class clown. Not everyone used comedy as an escape. And if you did do those things, if you did feel like an outsider, I could see you sort of like almost stepping back from that and going, oh, I suppose that's sort of everyone's thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm interested in that.
Well, it's. I definitely wasn't the class clown. I struggled during school. It wasn't a happy period for me because, I stood out in a Scottish school with an English accent initially. I wasn't the toughest. I had alopecia when I was younger, so I'd lost half my hair. So you already look a bit weird. I was the only 12-year-old girl at school with a comb over. You know, that's not good. In a period of your life when you really don't want to stick out, and you're like, oh, God. And then, 12, 13, beginning to realise I was gay, and you're like, right, okay.
Oh,
I've got a comb over.
Gay, bald English girl.
You're like, Jesus, really? All of this? So,
and how did that... I mean, we could still be flippant about it now, but that must have been incredibly tough.
Lonely, yeah. But it's... I mean, the hair grew back, and I'm now happily married. So, it all went well.
Yeah, you won. I don't know. I find that... I remember feeling very lonely when I was at school.
Yeah.
And I didn't stick out. And probably my reaction to you saying I was the freak, I've got quite a positive reaction to that. That was the defensive position that I took. I'd go, oh, right, well, I'll be a weirdo, and then they can't decide that they don't like me because I've already decided that.
Yeah, yeah. So, does it toughen you up? I don't know. I'm not a particularly tough person. But it certainly teaches you... to live perhaps not within the main herd, which is what I'm currently still doing. Doing this job, you're not living within the main herd. You often have people saying to you, I don't know how you do it. I mean, you've got no job security. You get up on stage. You've just got your own words. There's no pension planning. I'm just kind of used to not being with the main herd. And actually the thought of being with the main herd horrifies me.
Well, yes, I think that's really interesting because I feel like it was never an option to get a real job. It was never an option to be with the herd. But I wonder if that part of you at school, part of you kind of goes, right, well, this is who I am then. If I'm a weirdo, then certain rules don't apply to me. And freeing somehow? Or is there some relationship whereby what's attractive to you about comedy was the knowledge that it would provide you an alternate non-herd...
Lifestyle. I can't imagine ever being able to work in an office where we have to sing a mission statement, or indeed even look like you give a shit. I mean, unless I was working for something like Medicine Sans Frontières or something that was, you know, had a real sort of soul or purpose to it, I just can't fake it.
You can't be bothered to fake it? No, you don't want to fake it?
I wouldn't be able to give enough of a shit.
Do you think it's something to do with the fact that the herd are the people who regarded you as a freak at school?
Yeah, possibly.
Now
they're all sat there amongst their IKEA furniture living their standard lives. I think, fuck you, you twats. Yeah, I mean,
there's got to be a part of little Zoe going, ha, I fucking nailed this.
One of the people who bullied me at school is now living in a caravan with six kids. And I know it's an awful thing to say, but you know when you find out and just go
That's a side to you that I hadn't kind of noticed before. That you are not that I'm accusing you of anything awful, but there must be a certain amount of anger and a certain amount of
I'm never part of the Again, I think a lot of people feel this. Again, you're thinking you've got to ziplock it to a certain extent, but I've never felt part of the gang. I don't feel part of any particular comedy gang. I don't have that many comedy friends. I have certain friends who I'm very close with on the circuit, but only a very small few, and just never part of the big group.
And is that... That's because that's part of your... The way you view the world is that you don't want to be part of the group.
Possibly. I don't know. Maybe I'm an unpleasant person to be
around. Come on, you're a deeply pleasant person.
As if start going, actually, the common denominator here is me, isn't it?
No.
This is wherever I go, there I am. But perhaps from surviving school, not being needed to be in a big group, I don't think you ever do need to be in the big group. And then I see people who need to be in the big group, and then you think, you're only doing that because you're needy. And I'm not that needy.
You'll have to remind me what this bit refers to. I made a note from that show of yours. It says, onto the phone to your bank, I've made some very foolish investments.
Oh, yes. That's a routine I do about smoking weed in Amsterdam and how when you smoke weed as you get older, the effects are very different to when you're younger. I mean, I used to smoke quite a lot when I was younger. But if I smoke it now, it's just the things that sort of highlight in your head.
Oh, the anxiety,
the anxieties. You know, when you're younger, it's like, woo, okay, I can smell colour. And now when you smoke, you're like, I don't have a pension.
Yeah, that was it. I love that observation. That's great.
Yeah. It's very... It's weird, isn't it? One day you just sort of change. You're like, oh, okay, I'm now more concerned about... my financial future whenever I smoke dope.
How do you feel as a comic seeing comedians now barrel through who are younger and, you know, that way that the industry fetishizes youth? Do you feel that you're in charge of your career? Do you feel that you're where you want to be?
I'm not entirely sure. My big problem in life is that I've never been able to set strong definable goals. So I couldn't actually tell you if I'm where I want to be. I'm all right where I am. I think society is very youth obsessed. Why not? It's a beautiful thing and the skin pings back into place. I think it's very short-sighted. We're an aging population and audiences are changing and moving and just getting older. They're not going away, but they're getting older. There are people in the 50s and 60s who were, you know, 30 and 40, 20-odd years ago who still weren't entertained. And I think it's very short-sighted to plough a lot of energy into the youth market, a lot of it.
Do you think you're... I know what you mean. I find it very difficult to make goals.
Mm.
And I think in this job, it's hard to make goals because it's very difficult to measure
anything.
Sometimes
the fucking stadium's moved. By the time you've made a goal, you're like, I have set myself a goal. Oh, the stadium's gone. The stadium is gone. This is no longer an option. Yeah.
Yes, but I do. I wonder now whether, just because we've been talking in these terms, I wonder whether setting goals, measurable sort of goals, feels like a bit of a herd thing. to do. Maybe part of what attracts us to this is the fact that it's wild and indefinable and immeasurable in some sort of way.
Possibly, but then you do still have to pay the mortgage, don't you?
That is a definable goal.
That's a definable thing. That's a definite thing that needs to be done and considered. And to do that, then you have to consider what you are doing and how you are going to change what you are doing over the next 5 years to still be able to do what you are doing in an enjoyable way.
Does the future for you in comedy, does it have... Do you have any goals currently? Or does it stretch out in a kind of, I'm going to keep doing this... And the fact of doing it is success enough.
I don't know. The only definite thing I know is I definitely will not Ken Dodd it up.
What does that mean?
I will not be on the stage at 80.
Yes, okay.
I will not be there going, hey. No, it's not me. That will not
be. Do you
be
have an
me.
Exit strategy plan? No,
but I just find
I will die before I'm 80.
People love old-time entertainers who just keep going, and I find it the most tragic thing to
but
watch.
Ken Dodd wants to gig, doesn't he?
He gigs
what,
for
what,
so
what would you rather he do, sat in a chair?
Just, I don't get it. I don't get it.
Because to you, comedy is a means to an end?
Possibly. I don't know. I just do not want to be doing it when I'm 80. Mm-mm-mm-mm. I'll be the miserable old bitch in the care home with the chair facing the other way while they're all going, come on, Thao, let's sing around the piano. Go get I mean, I don't. I will not. No. Just doesn't appeal.
It's interesting. I'm
I mean, could
of...
you see yourself doing it at that age?
God, yeah.
Welcome
well...
to the stage. Two girls.
Dodd's on. I don't know. I don't. The idea of it doesn't horrify me.
Yeah.
In a way that it seems to horrify
Horrifies
you.
Horrifies me.
I don't know. It's interesting. I feel like I'm building a picture of you as kind of more of a maverick than I realised.
More of a miserable sot than you realised, possibly. Maverick sounds cooler, just more of a slightly miserable sot.
It's just a cool way of saying miserable sot.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but I think the idea is still... I would like to be able to do it if I want to. I mean, certainly that's why I wanted to move out of street performing. When I started doing comedy about 11 years ago, I'd been an actor for a couple of years, and before that I was full-time as a street performer.
Mm.
And I remembered looking around, because street performing, as we know, has got even less of a career plan or a few prospects and nothing over your head.
Yeah, a lot of them haven't even got anything to lean their ladders against, have they? I mean, it's just...
Poor bastards. But I remember seeing people I knew who were in their 50s doing street shows, and I remember thinking, I want to be able to do street shows when I'm 50. I don't want to have to because I didn't plan any other kind of job. So in stand-up, I suppose, one of the nice things about stand-up is that you can keep doing it when you're old.
You can keep doing it, absolutely.
So why is it so horrifying?
I don't know. It just really fills me with the thought of... I don't know. I think possibly because between now and then, I have set up a point where I will stop. In my mind, but I don't know. There's no other plan other than that. It will stop.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what will you do?
And I think.
Oh, go on. No, go on.
Because I love comedy. Absolutely love it, and I really enjoy what I do. But it's not my whole life. I enjoy other things. I'm just as happy sitting on a bench looking at a tree. I mean, I really. And if I could sort of engineer a way of making a living out of sitting
on
a bench.
So if you won the lottery tomorrow, if you won Euro Millions and got 20 million quid, you'd give up comedy?
I would clear my diary.
Would you?
Yeah. And I would put in the ones that I just really wanted to do. Just really, really wanted to do.
And how often would you put those in? Would you think I'll do one gig a month?
Probably four a month.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I'd really enjoy them.
Yeah. Who are we working with? Is it Russ? Russ Pears?
Pears, yeah.
Piers, he's lovely, Russ.
He's
a successful TV producer who's come to comedy later in his life and gone, I'll do this as a hobby.
Yeah.
And he looks like he's having an absolute ball. He's very funny.
I mean, there are people who would just do this until they expire, which is great and good for them, but it's really not for me.
I feel like Monaghan's going to overrun his life.
Do you know what I mean?
On stage when he's 150.
I mean, I quite like to be I quite like to work in a forest or something. Or I'd travel loads.
Yeah,
I suppose when you put it like that, the idea of like, oh, if I won 20 million quid tomorrow, I'd still do all my gigs. You go, you're an idiot.
Yeah,
there's a lot more to the world than just you satisfying your ego.
And I think I would enjoy it so much more, I think, if you could take all of that pressure off. Because you do certain gigs, because you've got to keep going, you know. And if you could just really enjoy the ones that you did, that'd be great.
What do you enjoy in other people's stand-up? What things mark someone out for you? Like, who are your, sort of not quite who are your comedy heroes, but what are the sort of things you like to see other people do?
I enjoy watching people who clearly are doing their own thing for themselves and don't necessarily pander to a crowd. I think James Acaster and Sarah Pascoe at the moment are sort of two really strong examples of that. Catherine Ryan as well, I really enjoy it.
I know almost nothing of Catherine Ryan. I know she's
awesome.
Exploding in the minute. I've seen very little of her stuff so far. She's definitely
awesome. Doesn't seem to care, which is...
it's very magnetic, isn't it?
Yeah. It's really, really good. Yeah, really good. So I enjoy people who, I don't know...
non-herd members again, isn't it?
Yeah. People not giving a shit, I suppose, is really lovely to see on stage.
And who were your contemporaries when you started? What were the circumstances of you starting comedy?
I had been to drama school. I'd left drama school.
Which one did you go to?
I went to the Paul School in King's Cross in London.
No way.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. So I'd done a little bit of fringe theatre and a very tiny amount of fringe theatre. And I generally played the comedic roles at drama school. I was a sort of club-footed maid. But I love that. but I love that, and that's just me, you know. Yeah. I love that, and I would love to have more opportunities to play club-footed maids. I think I could really do well at that. And it was becoming obvious that acting is a really weird world where you're like, oh, wow, you're really dependent on somebody else putting your face in a place.
Yes.
And it's got absolutely nothing to do with anything else other than your face, that place now. And you're like, oh, God, this is really, you can have no control over that whatsoever.
Yes.
So I started just
a lot less alternative than it seems.
Oh, God, it's awful. It's a horrific world. So I started to go and see lots and lots of open mic nights. Because I'd always loved stand-up. I'd always loved watching it. So I went.
Who were you watching? Who were your, like before you started? Who were your?
Well, it was Joe Brand and Ben Elton and Julian Clary and then Robin Williams and the American acts and Joan Rivers. Loved it. Always loved it. Had a very sort of romantic idea in my head of what a comedy club was. You know, it's a brickbat wall, it's low tables, it's little lights,
it's downstairs at the King's Head.
That's what they all look like.
And
I went to see loads of open mic nights. I had no idea how to write material. Some would say still don't. I had no idea how to approach it at all. But I just went to watch loads of open mic nights and just went, God, some of these people are really good and some of them are properly shit. So I reckon I could fit in the middle somewhere.
Yes. Do you remember people? Do you remember acts that you saw at an open spot level? I'm not asking you to name any shit ones, but I mean, you remember?
Oh, okay. Well, the first night, my first gig was Russell Kane's second gig.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was his second gig. It was my first gig.
And he was doing like 1,000 words a minute back then, wasn't he? That was when he started.
Yeah.
He was like super full on adrenaline.
Yeah.
God.
So that was.
So you started. How did you write stuff in the beginning? Did you go on with any ideas or did you just walk on and face plant into
my
it?
My first 5 minutes was at the King's Head in Crouch End. I'd written a hilarious routine about the sexing up of the weapons of mass destruction dossiers.
Hello, that was your first bit?
Yeah.
Don't be
impressed, you.
Go on.
It was really badly done. I'd sort of reproduced them as a sort of Mills and Boone sort of dossier. I thought it was hilarious. And it went down quite well. But it was only sort of, it was only when I started doing comedy to go back to what I was saying at the beginning, that I realised, oh, okay, I'm going to have to really think about what I'm writing and how I'm approaching this, because I'm not the most original or creative. So a lot of, I've had to learn learn how to do those bits.
When you say that you're not creative, I'm fascinated by that, because obviously you are creative.
Yeah.
Like, all of it, you've written at least 6 hours, not counting all the bits that were half decent but you cut.
Yeah.
You've written at least 6 hours of really funny stuff.
Yeah.
So you're clearly creative. You weren't just doing act outs for 6 hours.
No. But it's
so where does that belief come from that you're not creative?
I just don't feel that I'm original enough at times. It's so difficult, and I'm not even the first person to have had that thought today. So it's teaching yourself to try and be more creative, if that's possible, or more. Can you teach yourself to be more original? I don't know, but it's the one thing that constantly bothers me that perhaps isn't quite there.
And is that based on something that someone said to you? Is that based on a review? Is that based on...
No, not really. No. No.
Why do you think you're not creative? Nina Conti is obsessed with the idea that she's boring. Do you know what I mean? Which is preposterous.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering that, do people have these kind of hang-ups?
Yeah. I don't know.
And do you talk to your wife about this? Do you go, oh, God, I'm just not creative?
Yeah.
She slaps you and says something Dutch.
She says something Dutch. Hits you around the head with a clog. Yes, and she would argue that I was, but with all due respect to her, she's not a very creative person. She would be the first to admit that, you know.
I see what you mean, yes, okay.
If you ever try and play word games with her, it's just a nightmare. Let's play a game, Cindy. No. Okay. Think of the first thing that comes to your head. I'm not good at this. Okay, let's not do this. That's my hang-up. That's my thing.
And can you see yourself ever... Here's a question. Do you think that you will ever be able to think or learn your way out of that? Or is it such a precondition for you that even if you went on some incredible course for 2 years and learned about creativity and painted pictures and stuff, do you think that you'd still think, oh, no, but it's just me blagging it?
I don't know. I do try and write other things a little bit, and possibly because it's... On occasion, I've been asked to come up... You know when your agent goes to you, hey, you know, have you got any sitcom ideas?
Mm-hmm.
And you go, no.
No, I'm a stand-up comedian.
Absolutely
none. I write stand-up comedy.
Absolutely fucking none. None at all. And they go, well, go away and have a think about that. And you're like, okay. Still none. Still none there. It's not anything there. It's not anything there. So I think there's this idea that you should be sort of producing loads of stuff all of the time. You know, here's a script I've done and a sitcom. It's just not me. It's not me at all. It's not me.
So of your existing stuff, what is the bit that you are the most proud of?
There's been bits that I've just really enjoyed doing over the years that perhaps don't get the best response, but I've really enjoyed doing them. In a show a couple of years ago, I had a little scene between Monet and Manet, who were getting pissed off because they were getting confused on the art circuit in France in the late 19th century. And I used to thoroughly enjoy doing that piece of material. Sorry, I think I just spat, Stuart. Sorry about that. I got so enthused by my impressionists.
She's rabid with the artistic
fever. And it was quite clever. It was quite clever. It was, you know, it had a sort of cleverness to it. But it just... Because the thing that I really enjoyed doing... The reason I enjoyed doing that piece of material was because I thought, I bet there's fucking nobody else on the circuit doing Monet Manet stuff. I bet this is original.
Please don't email in if you're... And so it felt really original. Mm. It felt really different. And you didn't feel it got what it deserved.
Oh, no, it wasn't.
Was it a working bit? Could you do it in a club, or was it Edinburgh?
Oh, hello. Yeah. What these stags really want to hear about is the confusion between Monet and Manet in the late 19th century.
But haven't you just said that your favourite acts are the people who carry on regardless doing what they want to do?
Well, I do now, but that means I don't do the clubs that won't allow me to do the stuff that I've just stopped doing clubs that I don't feel comfortable in.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's an interesting, that must be a really good day in a stand-up's career.
It is, and you know, you've got to, you know, you take a financial hit, obviously.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you never need to do
those
funds.
But you know
what,
it's so much better than turning up and weeping in the corner because you feel so depressed at where you are. And I think it's never a good start to an evening if the entertainment is crying in the corner. Hi, I'm your entertainment. I'm really, really happy to be here.
Are you being defensively funny about it by saying crying in the corner? Or have you ever cried before a gig?
Yep.
Before a gig?
Yep.
Oh, you poor bastard. Oh. Tell me about that. I've cried after gigs. I've sat in the car after a TV warm-up.
Yeah.
And I felt like Annette Bening in American Psycho.
And had a little weep.
Just weeping and staring at myself in the mirror and going, yeah. What am I doing?
No, turning up, I think it was Nottingham Jonglers, as it was. Yeah. And just turning up outside.
The
and there was
the
just,
tear maker.
It was just a sea of women with doodly-bopper cocks on their head. And I just thought, this is ridiculous, though. You are so miserable. The smell of bleach and vom in the air at 9 p.m.
This isn't what comedy's supposed to be.
I was like, this isn't red brick with low tables and candles. This is not what you had in your head. And I did them for about 5 years.
And was there value? Did you get anything out of those sorts of gigs?
Well, I think you do learn. I mean, you learn how to do, you know, I have thrived, died and survived those gigs in equal measure. But come away with a... With any sense of fulfilment? No. I've said words I didn't want to say. I made things rhyme with dick. It's never a good feeling, is it? And when you do well at those gigs, you kind of go, I feel even worse now. I called somebody a C word. And, yeah, so I just stopped
doing it. And it worked, and it got a laugh.
And it worked, and it got a laugh, and somebody's shirt was gay, and that was hilarious, and, oh, God, the... You know, it's like, oh, God. So I just stopped
doing
it.
It's not very alternative, is it? It's like to perform to the herd, and in some sense it's quite literally
the herd
of identically dressed, you know, stags, hens, whatever.
You can do a couple of things. You can complain about them and still do them, or just complain and then just stop. Just don't do them anymore. I'd rather stack shelves and do those gigs anymore. Mm. I would. I've done them, and I won't do them again. Because I don't. It's not what it is in my mind. It's not what comedy is in my mind. It's not at all.
And are you? What's your comedy ambition? What's your professional ambition? I know you don't like to set goals, but is there a particular, like, is there a particular club in America you want to play, or is there?
No, I'm not that interested in breaking the stage.
A TV show that
people
you
get really obsessed with breaking the stage. And you go even. You know, Robbie Williams couldn't do it, and he sang Angels. If you can't break Milton Keynes' stables on a Saturday night, don't fuck off to LA and try and do that. Do you know what I mean? I would very much like to get into the position where I was doing tours and was able to comfortably sell a 300-seater. That's a lovely number, I think.
Because you've been on tour just at the minute.
I'm on tour at the moment, yeah.
Is this your first tour?
No, I've done about four.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, little tours. It's sure. Tiny. The tour I'm doing at the moment is a tiny, tiny little tour. And I think that would be really lovely to be able to comfortably sell a 300-400-seater, doing an hour and a half of your shtick.
And is that, in terms of, like, getting additional numbers in terms of, like, wanting that tour to be everything it can be, are you... Like, you've got radio profile, have you? Kind of radio for you, sort of turn up on things? You turn up
very
on...
Very rarely on Mock Radio the week. 4. You I do Mock the on... Week. I do Mock the Week. I've got... I've just filmed a spot on the John Bishop show that's going to go out in a couple of weeks' time in BBC. So I get things like that every now and again, and they're quite nice. It sort of bobs along. Bobs along. But I think to be able to get to a position where you're doing nice numbered tours, and I don't mean big rooms at all, I mean 300, you know, I'd really enjoy that, yeah.
We should wrap up, but first I would like to ask you, I've got two final questions. One is to review yourself as honestly as you can. If you were a reviewer reviewing you, what do you think your weaknesses are? What do you think your strengths are?
She did a cracking show. filled the stage with enthusiasm and energy. Occasionally, This is really hard, Stu. How are you supposed to do this? And did a 5-minute piece about a Danish banana that really I haven't considered before, but now, bless you, my child. But now
you don't need to do it in the voice of a reviewer. You're the only person that's responded to this challenge by sitting back and going, "Well, here's what I thought."
I know. I've combed my hair to one side, and I'm going to do it in the voice of a reviewer.
I suppose what I'm asking
touched is... upon subjects that, some would have thought really didn't need exploring.
I suppose what I'm asking is, we know what your strengths are. But what do you consider are the elements, like, do you see other people going, I wish I was a bit more like that. I wish I had that person's, you know, finesse or imagery or something. You know, what kind of bits are you...
Could have cut to the quicker. Cut to the chase.
Cut to the chase more quickly?
Cut to the chase more quickly, yeah.
Is that, what does that mean? You want shorter?
I tell you what it is, because occasionally I throw blancmange at a wall and see which bit sticks. So being a little bit more organised in the approach would be perhaps...
Yes.
Something for her to consider in her next show.
And finally then, what advice would you have for newer acts? And but you can be as specific as you like, because a lot of newer acts...
Never agree to do a friend's wedding. Never, ever do that. Don't do somebody's birthday. Never book yourself in for longer than you're capable of.
Oh, really?
Don't do that. Nobody's going to be impressed if you turn up with your baggy 10 and try and do a 20. Don't. Yep. Do what you can do. I've done that and died on my ass. Because you just think, oh, I'll wing it for the next 10 minutes. And you can't, you know, not when you haven't been going that long. So don't book yourself in for a 10 if you've only got 5. Do what you're capable of doing. Don't be scared of doing the same stuff again and again and again as well, sort of getting it right.
Is that what you did? That's what I think of as the Rod Gilbert technique. You have your 5 that gets incredibly good and then add a minute that's incredibly good.
No, I was a bit more ramshackled, you see. That was the most thing. I was a bit more haphazard. And I think there is a real benefit to taking your 5, 10, 15, 20 and honing it and getting that really good and then sort of branching out from there.
Do you play the Comedy Store?
Yes.
You're one of few women that play the Comedy Store.
I know. I have to dress up as a man to get in.
Who are the other girls that play the Comedy Store? Kerry?
Kerry plays the Comedy Store. Joe Caulfield. Gina when she's in town. I can't think of anybody else at the moment. Don't know whether Lucy still does it or...
And what... Is it, given that
Catherine probably does.
Catherine probably does it, I'm sure,
I mean, I've never gigged with another woman on the bill.
It's a really difficult one, because I want, on this show, I do like to explore the issue of why do people have this hang-up that women aren't funny? What should we be doing about it? All the rest of it. But I feel like as soon as you mention the issue
of... Do you know
what? You know what I mean? It's like, why don't we just stop fucking talking about it and maybe it'll go away?
I reluctantly engage with that, with the question of the notion, you know. And it often it amazes and amuses me that it's often women who come up to you after a gig and go, oh, I liked you. I don't normally like women. I don't normally find women funny. And you're like, well, your evening's out must be a right old barrel of laughs, mustn't they? 20 girls, none of you finding each other funny?
Yeah, of course. It's insane, isn't it?
What, you've never laughed at each other, made each other laugh, engaged in humour? What are you, some sort of vessel? Some void, vacuous vase of a woman? Get out of my sight. I don't want to be anywhere near you. We have nothing in common.
That is the final word on the subject. Thank you, Zoe. Thanks for talking to me.
It's a pleasure.
So that was Zoe, ladies and gentlemen. Apologies for the sound quality, not in that episode, but in these bits that I'm recording for you now. So that's all from Zoe. Thank you to her for coming on the show. Thanks to Nathan for all his efforts, as per usual. And follow at ComComPod to find out those Edinburgh Fringe guests. And remember Will Anderson on the 2nd of June at Soho Theatre and Adam Buxton, Dr. Buckles himself, Count Buckley's, on the 7th of July. So that's all for now. Thank you very much. I will speak to you very soon.
Thank you. Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks. You're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit a million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.